is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they'll be the views of Cal Grunwald, who has been with us in the past. He sells gold and silver. He supports Radio Liberty. We wanted to get his views of what's going on. Cal, how are you doing tonight?
Well, Dr. Stan, it's always good to be back.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Paul Volcker. Certainly, Paul Volcker, former president, chairman of the Federal Reserve System, about 1979 up till about 1987, certainly one of the dominant figures in international finance. Not only is he about 6'7", but he certainly is one of the leaders of this whole world monetary cabal. What does he talk about today as far as the crisis, financial crisis facing our nation?
Well, he gave about an eight-minute speech, probably a little bit longer than that, but very interesting. I watched it on YouTube, and he called what we're going through right now the mother of all crises. He was referring, of course, to this subprime mortgage meltdown debacle that is still in progress and really not any end in sight. And it was very interesting to hear him talk. He pretty much summarized how we've gotten into this place now, and with, out of control, unregulated, unsupervised, mostly unknown, over-the-counter derivatives and credit default swaps, which total over $45 trillion, and nobody really knows where they are, how much they are, and what kind of damage they can do. But when it starts unraveling, as it is now, we have to pay the piper. So he had a pretty informative speech.
Well, of course, certainly Paul Volcker knows what's going on financially. Is he optimistic about the future, or does he think we're going into a very, very difficult situation?
No, he gave no solution for the problem. He just again said this is the mother of all crises, and he gave no inkling of hope whatsoever.
Certainly, I was looking at a speech he gave here. This was 2005, an article he wrote for the Washington Post talking about what's going on, and he said the difficulty is that this seemingly comfortable pattern we're living in today can't go on indefinitely. I don't know of any country that has managed to consume and invest 6% more than it produces for long. The United States is absorbing about 80% of the net flow of international capital. And at some point, both central banks and the private institutions will have their fill of dollars. I don't know whether change will come with a bang or a whimper, whether sooner or later, but as things stand, it's more likely than not that it'll be a financial crisis rather than policy change that will force the change. Well, I think that we're seeing the financial crisis today. And it's one of the things that really bothers me, Cal, is that the dollar seems to be falling. It keeps going down and down and down. That's one reason why the price of oil is going up and up and up, is because the price of the dollar is going down. But most people really don't understand why is the dollar falling.
Well, again, there's all these excesses that that were conceived and spawned, 4, 5, 6 years ago, of course, be longer than that, obviously, but feeding the falling dollar. Now, the dollar on the euro is almost 158, and the dollar became parity with the yen about 2 weeks ago. It's continuing its free fall, and there's no end in sight there either.
Well, I think it was Lenin who said, there's no better way to destroy a nation than to botch the currency. And not one person in a million will understand what's going on. And most people don't understand. They're destroying intentionally the value of our currency to impoverish our people. We'll be back in just a moment with Cal Grunwald right here at Radio Liberty. Well, Cal, certainly as we were looking at what's going on, and you, of course, had suggested that maybe we ought to talk a little bit about Northern Rock and Citigroup and Bear Stearns and the implications of the failure of all of these financial institutions. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Again, I'm focusing on basically two things, and, you know, one is feeding the other. The falling dollar, I'm focusing on that, plus now the subprime mortgage meltdown is fueling it. And, of course, I'm sure your listeners have heard other people. I'm not the only one that is saying these things, but the subprime mortgage meltdown basically started 4 or 5 years ago when Wall Street, the government, the brokerage firms, investment banks, they thought up the latest scheme, you know, for not only, well, basically it was just to make money for themselves. And also, as a secondary, is to keep American spending, you know, because two-thirds of our economy, 70% of our economy is consumption, so you have to keep dollars in Americans' hands, and they have to keep going to Walmart to spend it in order to keep the wheels rolling. So what they did is they got together, and they decided they were going to put people into expensive houses, and these people had bad credit. And so most of these loans, as we're finding out now as they're coming around, were involved with fraud. You know, they were written. They cooked the numbers. They did falsified numbers. In fact, a banker, I talked to two bankers. One of them just came out and said most of these loans, they set a couple down and said, well, you don't have the best credit rating and you have thousands of dollars worth of credit card debt. And we'll kind of look the other way anyway because we want to put you in this nice house. And of course, the couple's not going to say no. We said, well, we have to have some income verification. So, if you say you make $30,000 a year and you want to get into a $400,000 house, that really doesn't fit. So, when you bring a pay stub that reflects a lot of overtime, you know, if you get paid every week, so the person did that, and then what they did is they photocopied that pay stub. It reflected a tremendous amount of overtime. They multiplied it times 52, and then you get your new yearly salary. The banker just, you know, plain said that. So then, of course, they paid off, you know, thousands of dollars worth of that couple's credit card debt, because when you have bad spending habits, you have bad credit, and you don't know how to handle money or manage it. So they put them into this, you know, extremely expensive house and gave them thousands of dollars in cash, cleared up their credit card debt, and then they're off spending again. And, of course, they introduced the teaser rates, which are low interest rates.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Cal was just talking about the origin of this problem as far as housing was concerned. We had a lot of people who could not afford an expensive home, and yet they were encouraged to buy it. They were encouraged to buy it with very, very low interest rates, or perhaps no interest rate at all. You don't have to pay your interest for a certain number of years, or you don't have to pay on the capital, you just pay interest. Certainly people who never could have really afforded a house were encouraged to buy houses by government policy, by the realtors, by the people who issued the mortgages, and they knew that these people would never be able to pay off their mortgages once the rates had gone up. And then the people who took all of those mortgages and bundled them into bonds and sold them as AAA bonds with a guaranteed income, knowing down the line, of course, they were going to default. And then the insurance companies that insured those bonds, and as derivatives, and of course what we're seeing now is this whole thing is coming unraveled, and Cal has given a very good overview of that. And of course what we're seeing now is what's the Federal Reserve System doing to try to counter this mess that we're in?
Well, they're pulling out all the stops, lowering interest rates to try to encourage people to borrow money. But on the flip side of all that, now the clarion call has gone out to tighten the restrictions to borrow money, because they just indiscriminately gave money to people that never should have received it. So now when there's money, more money available at a lower interest rate, they've tightened the restrictions so much, you know, nobody's qualified to get it. So that's not helping any either. And the first wave of this subprime mortgage thing, you know, hit in third quarter of last year. And one of the first victims was Northern Rock, which was the biggest bank in England. And in the middle of September, you know, as depositors found out, you know, it what happened to the, you know, to the bank, and they were defaulting on a lot of their loans and massive foreclosures. Most of the depositors left, and as a consequence, the bank was floundering, ready to go under, and you know, was, you know, that in that state for a month or two, and then the government finally came in and nationalized it. And so we have that kind of to look at, you know, for the banks in this country. In fact, the Fed is studying Norway's, you know, bailout policy, because that's what they did. They nationalized most of the banks. Now, Citigroup was the largest, is the largest bank in this country, and they took a $11 billion loss, third quarter, $18.1 billion, fourth quarter. January and February's numbers were worse than the previous month. And they got billions of dollars from you know, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, and but again, those Arab nations are the ones that only ones that have real money, because they have oil. And they said, well, that's enough of that. They're not going to give any more money, and Citigroup is ready to go under. And of course, Bear Stearns was going to go under. But the Fed, you know, through a J.P. Morgan Chase, which is illegal, but they did it anyway, bailed them out, bought them for one-tenth of their value. It's all fraud. But what did Bush do at the end of the whole thing? He told the Fed and Bernanke, you did a great job, keep it up. And there's more where that is.
Well, of course, many people feel that the reason that they bailed out Bear Stearns is because they had some $13.4 trillion in derivatives. Now, of course, what's a derivative? These are guarantees that loans will be paid. And so there are all these people who bought these bonds throughout all across the world. And of course, Bear Stearns is guaranteed those bonds are going to be paid. And of course, Bear Stearns had nowhere near enough money to pay off $13.4 trillion in derivatives of the, basically, the insurance policies they'd written. And I think there was a great fear that if Bear Stearns went down, the whole financial structure of the world would come down. $13.4 trillion is a substance, is a figure that is greater than, actually just about equivalent to what the United States, the entire American economy is at the present time. I mean, certainly our federal debt, our federal expenditures is about $2 trillion today. The entire American economy is a little over 12 or 13, and here this one company has $13.4 trillion in derivatives. I think they really didn't have much choice to other than to try to save that. Otherwise, the whole financial structure built upon debt would come tumbling down. Well, certainly the Fed is pouring an awful lot of money out there at the present time, aren't they?
Well, they are. In fact, what they're admitting to since December, they've pumped in $310 billion into the banks, and now they're offering another $50 billion, you know, in the slush fund pool for anybody to borrow from, and everybody's coming to the trough, to take their drink. So it's a pretty bad situation. You probably heard that the FDIC pulled 25 resolution managers out of retirement to handle all the bank failures this year, and one of them admitted off the record anonymously that they expect thousands of bank failures this year. And as you said, that's very true. If they would have let Bear Stearns go, it would have started the huge domino effect, and we'd probably be in the middle of a total mess right now. So the Fed just kind of prolonging the agony as best they can by lowering interest rates and pumping in hundreds of billions of dollars into the banks. Now, that money is not going to the public, so the public isn't spending it. And so that's why we're in a recession. And both Greenspan and Warren Buffett, they both said, you know, America's in a recession, and now Bernanke is kind of admitting it through the back door. But we are. And there's really no solution for the problem. And what they're not saying is that they're saying there's really no end in sight, and there's really another 3 years of this subprime mortgage thing to unfold or unwind, or come unglued. And no one's really saying that. They just said there's really not a solution for the problem.
Well, I think, Chris, there are about 8,500 banks in the United States. Some of them are big, some of them are small, but They are anticipating many of these banks are going to go belly up because the problem is not a matter of liquidity. In other words, not enough money. And the problem is a matter of solvency. In other words, many of these banks are insolvent because they've bought these CDOs, these collateralized debt obligations. They bought the ABSs, that's the asset-backed securities. They bought the SIVs, that's the structured investment vehicles. And none of these are solvent bonds. And, of course, they're expecting a certain income from them. The income is not coming. Probably when they bought them, they actually took out these insurance policies, which they call credit swaps or derivatives. And, of course, there's no money there to back that up. And that market is somewhere in the market between $500 and $700 trillion. And this whole financial structure of not only the United States, but the world, I fear, is coming down. The Chinese stock market earlier this in March, over a period of about 2 weeks, lost 20% of its values. And stock markets throughout the world are crumbling. The only reason ours doesn't crumble is because it's being artificially manipulated by the Working Group on Financial Markets. It's perfectly legal, established by presidential directive under the Reagan administration. It's all right to manipulate the stock market if you're the government, and so the Treasury and certainly the Federal Reserve System and a couple of the big banks are simply manipulating our stock market, so we're not going the way that the European markets, the Chinese market, other markets throughout the world are going, but it's all artificial. Nothing really is, of course, has any validity in fact, but of course they are fearful that if the American people ever begin to panic, the whole structure, financial structure, of the United States could crumble. Now, what about the bankruptcies? What are they doing, Cal?
Well, there was just an article a few days ago that bankruptcies were up 30% in March. That's 90,000 new bankruptcies in this country. And so these things are just going to continue exponentially as all these loans, you know, these mortgages, these bad mortgages come due. And, you know, obviously the people couldn't make the payments in the first place, and so they certainly aren't going to be able to pay at a higher rate, you know, as they go forward. So basically, you know, we're going to continue with record after record of bankruptcies until what's going to happen. We also have 28 million Americans on food stamps, and that number is growing too.
And of course, I think what people have to understand is that certainly they've already foreclosed on over a quarter of a million homes, because another 600,000 homes that they can very soon will be going into foreclosures, and probably all in all, about 2 million people, Americans, are going to lose their homes as those homes then are put on the market or auctioned off. Their value goes down, and it lowers the value of all of the housing in that neighborhood. And this is really what's happening. A lot of these foreclosed homes are just sitting there. Nobody mows the lawn. Nobody takes care of the house. It begins to create an increasingly slum-like atmosphere. One of the government's programs to solve the problem is to offer counseling to all those people who are losing their homes, appropriating $100 million so they can help the 250,000 American families that have lost their homes, $4,000 a family for counseling to make you feel better about actually having to leave your home. In fact, somebody the other night, I guess it was just last night, was talking about the tent cities outside of Los Angeles where people are going because they don't have any homes and they're just putting up tents. And fortunately, one of our listeners checked it out, sent me the link to it, and apparently there's a gigantic tent city growing in Ontario, California. We'll be back in just a moment here to talk about it, but a gigantic tent city growing for people who've lost their homes. Of course, you sitting in the comfort of your home and listening to the program aren't that concerned, but believe me, there are an awful lot of people who are going to be hurting. And we're just at the beginning. This is not the end. When the recession's not almost over, half over, this is just the beginning of what happened, of course, back at the time of the Great Depression. And, of course, the same basic forces are at work. The same people are in charge. Our economy is controlled by a small clique of people who established the Federal Reserve System, a privately owned central bank, set up for the bankers to enrich the bankers and to impoverish the people, and that's just what they're doing today. Well, Cal, certainly as we look and see what's going on today, Chris, we hear stories about the shortage of silver. Have you run into this at all? Are there really any shortages of silver out there?
There are shortages of silver, that's true, but they're not as severe as we're led to believe by a lot of silver pundits. The real shortage is in gold, and gold production is the lowest it's been since 1931, and it's diminishing all the time. The South Africa is the largest producer of gold in the world, and its production is down 11% from the previous year, which was down 9% from the year before that. So we've got a huge shortage of silver. China can't keep gold on the shelves or in the shops or whatever because the Chinese know the value of gold. India, Korea, Russia, they're huge buyers of gold. Americans are basically still asleep. Even a small portion of them wake up and decide to buy gold, just a little bit of gold that's available now is going to be gone. So I'm encouraging people to buy as much gold as they can right now. And you should be able to pick up a little bit of silver later that you need.
Well, now, of course, can you actually get the 90% silver bags at the present time?
Yes, I don't have any problem with that. I have talked to people. Say that you can't get them, but I don't know where they're getting their information because they're still available out there.
I see. And so you can actually, if somebody were to call you tomorrow and try to get a bag of silver, 90% silver, you can get it for them?
Oh, yes, for sure. In fact, the lady this morning ordered two bags, one bag of dimes, one bag of quarters, and I didn't have any problem at all.
All right, fine. What about silver bars, silver rounds, or silver eagles? Can you get
those? Well, I can still get those, but I don't recommend them for practical reasons. See, silver bars, whether you've got it an ounce or 10 ounce, 100 ounce, or 1,000 ounce, they're very impractical because, I have a very practical approach to buying gold and silver because you're looking down the road to what you can do with it. And most people ask me the question, well, how can I use my gold or silver for barter? Or how can I use it later on? And, of course, I'm looking at the day when the dollar fails and then gold and silver will be the only money. And the reason I recommend the junk silver is because, like dimes, quarters, and half dollars, these coins were minted from 1917 and 1964, and they were 90% silver. Now, they're ideal for small barter situations. After the dollar collapses, you can use a dime or quarter, half dollar to buy a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk or a dozen eggs. If you have, a 10-ounce silver bar, and if silver is $50 an ounce, it's worth $500. So yeah, if a loaf of bread is $10 or $15 or $20, how are you gonna get change from that? Or even a silver round, it's a 1 ounce, or a silver eagle's a 1 ounce. Again, it just becomes too cumbersome. It's not bad to have a few of those, but you want to concentrate on having, your small denominated, what's called junk silver, 90% silver coins. And you have to do, there's another thing that kind of really concerns me, because I run into a lot of people who have bought into this silver pundit euphoria buying. Like, silver has a huge multiplier, like 11-to-1 multiplier, and gold is only a 5-to-5-to-1 multiplier. What that means is that
hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Cal Grunwald. Well, this is Dr. Stan. He's just talking to Cal, and he says he's not having any trouble at all getting silver coins. What does a bag of silver coins cost at the present time? Do you have any idea?
Let's see. What was that?
No, it's 90% silver.
Yeah, somewhere around $14,500 to $15,000, somewhere in there.
$14,500 to $15,000. Okay, and of course you were talking about the multiplier as far as this is concerned. What is the multiplier and how does that work?
Well, basically, the people who are applauding silver and encouraging people to buy a lot of it are saying that you can make a lot of money. You can make much more money on silver than you can on gold because it has 11-to-1 multiplier. So say, for instance, that they were saying that when silver was $8 or $9 or $10 an ounce. So basically, they're saying that when the dollar collapses, silver will get to $100 or $110 an ounce. You're basically up, you know, up to 10 or 11 times. And gold is, say it's at 1,000, it can only get to like 5,000, which is a 5-to-1 multiplier. So they say, well, naturally then, if you want to make money, the thing to buy is silver. Well, what they don't, what these people don't tell people and don't look down the road to the next logical two things that are going to happen is, when the dollar fails and becomes worthless, who are you going to sell your silver to, and what are you going to get in exchange? If there is no currency, how can you make money? It's a moot issue. The second big argument they use for silver, for buying a lot of it, is that there is a tremendous industrial demand. Well, industry is almost dead in this country already, and the only, you know, the big three, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler are left, but they're on the bankruptcy ropes too. So when the dollar collapses, there will be no industry. So there goes the second argument out the window. There is no industry to sell it to, and furthermore, if there were, if the dollar, you know, when the dollar's collapsed, what are they going to give you in exchange? There is no currency. So it's not about making money, and their arguments go up in smoke, but nobody goes down that logical road except me, I guess.
Well, of course, but then by the same logic, if you have gold, and of course the system collapses and you can't get any currency, what are you going to do with your gold?
Well, again, that's a very good question, too. Now, the reason I recommend the junk silver is because that's like the money in your wallet, your ones, your fives, your tens, to buy food, buy small items that you need. But you have to do silver in moderation. You know, a bag of silver, $1,000 face value bag of silver weighs 55 pounds. A half bag is 27, 28 pounds. But you've got those definite advantages with silver, but the disadvantages of silver are numerous. You've got weight, bulk, volume, storage, mobility. You've got all those as disadvantages. Now your gold is there as your core of wealth. So 90 to 95 or 98% of your wealth should be in the gold coins, because it's a very compact store of value. If you ever have to leave quickly, you can grab your gold in one hand and take off, and you've got a tremendous amount of wealth concentrated with your gold coins. And I kind of use the example, if you bought 2 pounds of gold coins, and you have 50 pounds of silver, and the dollar collapses and you have to leave quickly, you know, you're going to grab your 2 pounds of gold, and it's probably worth $300,000, or you're going to grab your 50 pounds of silver that's probably worth $40,000, which, what are you going to do? Well, you're obviously going to grab your 2 pounds of gold and get out the door. And that silver is going to be left for somebody else. So you've got to think about that also, not in panic or paranoia, but, you know, it's a very logical thing that's going to happen all over the country when these things take place. When the dollar collapses, we're going to have all kinds of chaos of every sort.
Well, I fear that certainly we're going to see some very, very difficult times, and financially, because Cindy, I believe that they intend to destroy the dollar. Why would anybody want to destroy the dollar? Because, of course, they realize that when you have a sovereign currency, you have sovereign nations, and each nation has its own currency, you can't ever establish a world government. If you want a world government, why, you have to have a world currency, and that's really what they're planning down the line. You can read, of course, this plan in the Foreign Affairs magazine published by the Council on Foreign Relations, which is America's secret government, and of course their logo on the front is a man riding a white horse. Gee, I wonder what that means. Well, anyway, of course, if what they're really talking about is a global currency backed by gold, which is, of course, privately issued by the people who control the wealth of the world. And, of course, these people, by issuing the currency, the global currency, will control the world, because he who controls the money controls the politics of the nation. And if you doubt that, you go back and you read what Professor Quigley had written on page 325 or 324 of his book, Tragedy and Hope, where he talks about how the central bankers of the world, and believe me, the Fed is a privately owned central bank, not a branch of our government, contrary to what everybody wants to tell you, but how they meet together in secret sessions, planning on how they're going to establish a feudal society. And you can see that in my little pamphlet, quoting Professor Quigley, called The History of Money. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Cal Grunwald, and of course, we're talking about what's going on financially. Well, do you want to, Chris, to get a little bit into what's happening here? I noticed one of the things you talked about was the airlines that have shut down. We know that three of our major airlines actually shut down last week. We know, of course, that American Airlines has been grounding literally thousands of flights every day. What's going on with our airlines?
Well, again, people are cutting back flying, and it's basically the recession plus the increased cost of fuel that is causing the airlines to shut down. They were not doing well a couple of years ago, and a lot of them were on the bankruptcy ropes at that point, and came out of that. But now things are too bad, so they're going under. So we've got, you know, was it American Airlines canceled 2,500 flights today, and this is just the beginning of the unraveling too there. So it's a bad situation all around.
All right, because my thesis on this is that other FAA is making all sorts of unreasonable demands on major airlines, which I think have done a pretty good job. And, of course, they're forcing them to close down their flights because I think they want to wreck the airline industry, because I think they want to really, of course, get us out of airline travel. There's a couple of professors over in Australia who said people shouldn't be flying every place. I mean, they ought to be walking, riding their bicycles, you know, get out of their cars, and certainly get out of the airlines. And of course, people should take, you know, flights every year. They shouldn't take a flight every year. Maybe take one airline flight every lifetime. But everybody else should be staying close at home rather than polluting the environment. Is that what they're doing? Is that why they're putting so much pressure on our airlines today? I don't know, but there certainly is a possibility. Well, what's happening to the housing market? You mentioned Las Vegas and some of the other areas in the country where really the property values are falling and falling dramatically. Is that correct?
Well, it is. there's only a few areas in the country that are still relatively strong or else still treading water. Detroit is basically a ghost town. About 70% of the houses are already vacant. I talked to a realtor who was trying to sell a house in Las Vegas, and he said, you know, of course, these things don't hit the media, but there's thousands of houses, that are sitting there, no buyers. And he said he's already reduced the price of the house that he's trying to sell by half, and it still doesn't move. There's no nibbles or anything on it. He said commercial property is selling. Of course, you've got, you know, Las Vegas, the Sin City, so there's always going to be a market for that. But as far as the houses, no, in many, many areas in the country, it's the same thing. Of course,
hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment with Cal Grunwald. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Cal Grunwald. Cal, would you like to get out your telephone number, your website?
Sure. I've got a brand new website since I've been on. It's very extensive and it's real good. It's not because I did it, because I'm not the webmaster, but my website is goldandsilverexchange.info. That's goldandsilverexchange.info. And then my phone number, you can reach me anytime, is 414-234-8267. That's 414-234-8267. I also have a phone with unlimited minutes, and I just tell people when you call me, you know, please just say, can you call me back? Because, you know, it doesn't cost me any more to talk 10,000 minutes or 20,000 minutes, so I'll be glad to do that and talk with you as long as you'd like me to.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY if you have a question for Cal. And, of course, what about, Sydney, the transmission shop story? What was that all about?
Well, it's interesting. I had some transmission work done from time to time in a shop in Green Bay, and he's a kind of a one-man shop, and I've been in there over a period of years as I've had different cars that needed work. And he was always just kind of, you know, struggling to keep the doors open. Last time I was in there, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, he was just buried. He was so swamped. He hired 2 or 3 people. His car's all over the place. And I said, what's going on? He says, I can't keep up. And he said, well, I'm not just doing transmission work now. I'm rebuilding engines. I'm doing body work. He said, these, you know, the transmission shops, these big dealerships, they've been going under, and they, you know, the big transmission shops that hire, you know, that have a 10, 12 staff, they're not there anymore either. They went under, so all these people are all looking for jobs, and you know, people are bringing their cars to him because he's still open, and now he's rebuilding engines. He's never done that before. And he said people are bringing in their 2002, 2003, 4 cars, and rather, you know, these people would be buying brand new cars. Typically, they can't afford them, so they can pay $1,000 for a rebuilt engine, but they're not going to buy a new car. So he said this is what's happening right now, and he said this is really a sad story. He's really happy that he's still working, but he said everything else around him has just been going under.
And, of course, I think what we're seeing is the really shutting down of the automotive industry. Certainly General Motors is going to cut dramatically on the number of cars they're producing this coming year. The same thing for Ford and Chrysler, because they've actually been selling their cars at a loss. It's the only way to actually have kept their assembly lines open, and they have to keep them open because of the contracts they had, of course, with the unions. Well, of course, those contracts have been renegotiated, and the new contracts do not require them to keep the lines open. They're buying out a lot of the people who were there working for them, regular employees, union members, and they're giving them $100,000 to $125,000, $130,000 simply to quit. And, of course, then they're hiring new people. And instead of paying the $68 they were paying before, which included benefits, pension, health benefits, and then, of course, salary, new people are getting $14 an hour without, of course, any benefits at all. And so hopefully in a year or two, they're going to be able to get their production back up again. But this coming year, all of the major automotive industries in America, even Toyota, are going to be cutting back on their production because, of course, they know that people are not going to be buying cars because we are entering a recession. I think we're well on the way to a depression. Do you think it's going to be a depression or recession, Cal?
Well, we're in a recession and we're headed for depression. There's no way to avoid it. It's impossible. There is nothing in place. No, you need jobs. You need good jobs for the economy to keep going, and yeah. There aren't any good jobs anymore. They all got shipped overseas with GATT and NAFTA and CAFTA and, you know, everything else. It's impossible. We are headed for a depression. There's no way to stop it.
And I think what people have to understand, basically, is that the banks just are not loaning anymore, because a lot of them would face insolvency if they lent money and they didn't get it paid back. And so the banks are simply cutting back on loans. It's very difficult now to get a loan. You can get them for houses, although the interest rates have gone up somewhat. But you certainly have to be somebody who can put something down for that house. You're going to have to come up with, maybe 10, 20% of the value of the home. And you have to have a good credit rating, or they're not going to sell you a home. They can't afford, of course, to get any more foreclosures. And so we're finding the money for commercial developments, for buying other corporations, all of this money is drying up. And so many of the deals that were in place, there were one corporation was going to buy another, suddenly they're just calling them off. What the average individual out there doesn't understand is that we have a number of our major financial institutions, not only in the United States but throughout the world, that are completely insolvent, that they hold all sorts of bonds. They have no idea what their value is. They can't figure out what they are because, of course, there's no way to determine what the value of these bonds for student loans, for automobiles, which people, of course, not paying the automobile loans, they're not paying back the student loans, the homes, the so-called collateralized debt obligations. These banks are holding material they have no idea what it's worth, and that's why they don't dare loan at this time. And, of course, even the Federal Deposit Insurance Company, as Cal said, is calling back retired employees in preparation for a cascade of bank failures all across America. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question, if you have a comment, we'd love to hear from you. What about the IRA strategy? There are a lot of people, of course, who have IRA pension funds. A lot of people have regular pension funds, and I think people in a lot of these funds are worried because Their pension funds may very well have certainly have bought these collateralized debt obligations, these asset-backed securities, these structured investment vehicles, and their pension funds are going to be in trouble, especially when the stock market begins to drop, which it will sooner or later as we proceed with this bear market. So what should people be doing with their pension funds, Cal? What should they be doing with their IRAs?
Well, I'm suggesting to people that you take a pretty hardcore approach to getting out of your IRAs. And, of course, they've got everybody saddled in a corner with penalty plus taxes if you take it out because it's tax-deferred. But you have to kind of make a decision either to, you know, it's better to have 50% of something than 0% of nothing. And I'm just kind of suggesting to people that, you know, that if you take, you know, you're less than 59.5, you'd have to have a 10% penalty. So you could pay that. And then you have to use kind of $100,000 as kind of a hypothetical. If you had a $100,000 IRA, you'd take your $10,000 in penalty, and then you'd have maybe $30,000 in tax consequences, and then you're left with $60,000 of principal. So what I'm suggesting doing, there's nothing illegal about this, but I think it's very wise, is you take your principal money of $60,000 plus your tax money of $30,000, and you buy gold with it, and you sit on the sidelines. Now, gold went up $400 an ounce in the last, say, 5 months, and of course it was over 1,000. They knocked it back down to, you know, a little less than 900, and it's at 930 right now, coming back. But basically, you're sitting then with real money in your hand, and you're watching from the sidelines while the mealy takes place. Now, in the middle of all this, the dollar is in a free fall, so the dollar literally could go any day. If the dollar collapses in a month or two or three or four or five or even toward the end of the year, gold will instantly become $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 an ounce because it'll be the only money. And then you're sitting there with all that money in your hand. The dollar collapses. There are no more taxes because there's no more government to exact or oppress you with taxes. And you've tripled, quadrupled your money. If the dollar doesn't collapse, and next April rolls around when tax time is there, and if gold has gone up at a conservatively $300-$400 an ounce from what it is now, sell a little bit of your gold to pay your taxes, and you're still going to come out with the lion's share of your money and make a profit on top of it. So it's really a no-lose proposition.
Well, of course, we actually know, first of all, that the unemployment figures the government is putting out are really totally inaccurate. They're simply a lie. They tell us that there were 80,000 jobs lost last year. But if you do household surveys, in other words, there are people who actually call a large numbers of homes to see if somebody's off, they figure that probably there were 460,000 jobs lost last month. That's covered in the latest Wellington newsletter and, of course, in Bob Chapman's newsletter as well. In other words, they're simply lying to the American people so that they won't realize how bad things are. They say that there is essentially no inflation, or just a little bit of inflation, and they keep talking about the core inflation rate at 2.1%, and that's, of course, the rate at which they increase your Social Security check. That is the rate at which they increase the value of your T-bills, which are indexed for inflation. But the truth of the matter is the current rate of inflation is 10 to 12%, and they're simply lying about that after all, but think they have to lie about it, because if they didn't lie about it, they would have to give the people who are on Social Security and the people who have Treasury bonds that are indexed for inflation, they'd have to give them the additional money. And they don't want to do that because they don't have the money. And they're paying out over $400 billion a year just in interest on the national debt. Interest on the national debt will soon be one of the major things on the budget today. But of course, they're having to pay interest on the national debt, and think it would double over a period of 3 or 4 years simply by telling the people the truth about inflation. Well, of course, the people who are watching inflation rates will tell you that the N3 rate, which government says it just can't figure out anymore, it's been able to calculate it for the last 30 or 40 years, but they just, well, it really doesn't do any good. But the M3 rate, which they do not want you to know about, is running over 17%, which reflects where we'll be as far as inflation by the end of the year. And if we go from that 10 to 12% to 17% by the end of this year, it means that your currency, anything you have in dollars, has lost 17%. Right now, you're losing 10%, 10 to 12% a year. And, of course, there is no way out. The government's going to have to keep printing more and money and more money and more money. And sooner or later, why, you destroy the value of the currency. This is what's happened in every country that's gone into a fiat money system down throughout history, whether it happened in ancient Greece, whether it happened in ancient Rome, whether it happened at the time in Florence when they had their central bank, or in Venice when they had their central bank in the 1400s and 1600s. They know what's going to happen. They know there's no way they can keep this together. And, of course, they really have a personal advantage in doing that, in destroying the value of our currency, because then we'll be forced to go into the global currency and the global government. Well, Cal, how soon do you think this is going to be happening? Do you have any thoughts at all? Dollar's going to maintain value?
Literally, the dollar could go in months, if probably at the outset, maybe a year, year and a half. I don't see it going any further than that, because what the Fed is doing now is creating money out of thin air by the multitudes of hundreds of billions, and that's tremendously hyperinflationary. And now they're talking about inflation, but as you said, they're just lying about the number. I did a very good, very interesting study, little research on my own about actual inflation numbers, and it's in my paper. It's on my website.
All right, and what is that website again?
It's www.goldsilverexchange.info, like an information. So it's goldsilverexchange.info. And what I did, just in brief, this was in May of 2006, I did this, but I went to the international futures charts, and I picked 8 different commodities that people would use on a day-to-day basis. Not everybody would use all these, but they were reflective of the food, fuel, and energy categories that food, fuel, or housing. And, of course, the CPI index does not include the big three, and if you take out the big three, which is basically 95% of all the money people spend, if you factor out 95%, the only thing you have is a few percent, and that's where they come up with their goofy number. But anyway, I picked these 8 different commodities, whether it was electricity, propane, natural gas, unleaded fuel, propane, sugar, coffee. There was one other too. But anyway, I went on the international futures chart, and I did May of 2003, and I wrote down the cost of that commodity. Then I jumped 2-3 years later to May of 2006 and wrote down the cost, what it was selling for. Then I did the percent increase for all these different 8 different commodities divided by 8, and across the board they increased 106.6% divided by 3, because it was 3 years, 35.5% actual inflation of those 8 commodities over a 3-year period. Now, I read in the Wall Street Journal today, rice has gone up 147% in the last year, wheat's gone up 112%. I mean, we've got commodities just going through the roof now, craziness. And then it was really ironic, because in one column it was talking about the price of those food items. In the other column there was the inflation chart that indicated 2.4% inflation in this country. It was just a joke. I don't think they even realized they were doing it, but they did it.
Well, I think people have to understand that when the government will lie to the public about what's happening as far as inflation, this is obviously the same thing that happens in every country where, of course, they set out to destroy the value of the currency. They cannot let the people understand, because, of course, people work their whole lives. So they'll have a pension, so their pension fund will be solvent. You'll get your money, of course, out of your pension fund, but, if you have $1,000 a month, why, it may not buy a loaf of bread. It certainly wouldn't probably buy a good meal any place. And you go to Rhodesia, in Rhodesia, we call it Zimbabwe today, the government that was installed by your State Department under Mugabe was a lifelong communist Chinese-trained terrorist. Mugabe, of course, was a lifelong communist. We installed him in Zimbabwe. Their inflation rate there today is 100,000%. 100,000% a year. And remember, Henry Kissinger promised the people of Rhodesia that if things ever got out of hand, why, America would come to their aid. Well, I don't know when America's going to come to their aid. Suddenly over 5 million Rhodesians have fled their country. Starvation is rampant. There are no medications there. And of course, they're on the verge of a revolution. Cal, let's get your telephone number out one more time and, of course, your webpage.
It's 414-234-8267. That's 414-234-8267. And it's goldandsilverexchange.info.
Goldandsilverexchange.info. All right, fine. If you're out there, you have a question, telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Well, Cal, why don't you go ahead? You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
I want to tell everybody that, you know, it's been a while since I've been on the show, and I'm glad I'm back, but people know me from before. They know that I'm not an alarmist, and I'm not going to, you know, cry wolf when I don't see a wolf. But now, for the first time, I see the wolf, and he's in the form of the subprime mortgage meltdown, which is collapsing the dollar, and everything else is unraveling around it. So I'm just telling people, basically, it's time to do something in rather, rather hurried steps, if you will, you know, to get out of your electronic or paper investments, anything that's dollar-denominated, whatever penalties you have to pay or taxes you may have to incur. It's the time to get out and have a plan to sit on the sidelines. You should have 4, 5, 6 months worth of food. You should have a cash cushion that you feel comfortable with. Basically, you should have enough silver for barter to maybe half a bag or a bag, and then put the rest of your money into gold coins and sit on the sidelines and watch, because what's happening right now around us has never happened before in our history. But we are seeing history repeat itself, because every paper currency ever printed has failed, and we're watching that right now.
And what sort of coins?
To do something to get out of the way.
And what sort of coins should people be buying? Should they be buying Kruger Rands, Austrian Coronas? Should they be buying the gold coins minted by our mint? What should they be buying?
Well, again, I recommend what's called the old gold or semi-numismatic. You know, the old $10 and $20 liberties and the lightly circulated grades. So the premium is very close to spot. You have some protection from a confiscation. They also have tremendous upside potential. All right, they have a little bit of bullion like American Eagles or Maple Leafs or Kruger Rands, but that's risky too, because they're confiscatable and the payback is only $50 an ounce. So those are the coins that I recommend. Also on my website now, there's a silver formula that I could tell people about it, but I don't have any time. But I explain to people how they can buy small quantities of silver at like a local coin shop and not get ripped off, because I give a formula for them to figure out the true value of that coin so they can be educated buyers when they go into the shop.
All right, fine. Of course, what is the amount of silver in a 90% silver coin? What is it, about 7/10 of a...
A dime is 0.07 of an ounce, a quarter is 0.18, a half dollar is 0.37, and a silver dollar is 0.78.
Okay, fine. Well, our guest has been Cal Grunwald. Cal, it's good to have you with us, back with us again, and we'll probably be talking to you again next month.
All right. Thanks, Doctor.
Bye-bye. Okay, we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we keep talking about the finances because we hope you're going to get your affairs in order, get out of debt while you can, because, of course, you never know when you may lose your job, and if you were to lose your job, why, of course, you'd lose your home as well. And so get things straightened around, because we're in for difficult financial times. If you've not, of course, heard my talk on Financial Tsunami, let me recommend that and the syllabus that goes with it. We gave it perhaps a year and a half to 2 years ago. But, of course, it's just as true today as when we gave it. And then you need to get our little pamphlet on the history of money. and our pamphlet on the financial meltdown, because they will help you to understand what you should be doing now to protect your lifelong earnings. And then, of course, the wonderful book written by our good friend Ed Griffin called The Creature from Jekyll Island. That's Creature from Jekyll Island. Is available from Radio Liberty. And, of course, the book The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, or the book The Fiat Money Inflation in France. Those three books, Creature from Jekyll Island, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, and The Fiat Money Inflation in France. Three important books, along with my talk and two pamphlets. If you read those, you'll know more than most economic professors do, and you'll be in a position to understand what you should be doing at trying times like this. And there are three laws of investment. Diversify, diversify, diversify. Why? Because you do not have to have all your eggs in one basket, else someone come along and step on that basket and wipe you out financially. We are entering times like we've never been in before, and those people who are not making preparations, who are going along and acting as if they're certainly have nothing to worry about, an awful lot of those people are going to get wiped out before this financial crisis is over. There are people in the major mainline media who are going to be telling you everything's fine, but things are not fine. The people within the Federal Reserve System, the central bankers, are panicking. They do not know what to do. And, of course, they're doing what they have always done in the past. They're simply printing new money. They're creating new money. The Fed only has $800 billion, of course, to use in case of an emergency. They've already expended, as of about a month ago, $400 billion of that. And what happens when they no longer have, of course, any reserve of currency to use to try to stabilize the dollar, our economic system? I mean, what happens, of course, when foreign countries begin refusing to buy American bonds? We have to sell raise $2.5 billion every day. $2.5 billion every day just simply to meet our financial obligations. And as things go by, of course, this year is going to be very unusual. This is the first year where Medicare income will not be up to what it's going out. In other words, in the past, we've always had more money going into Medicare than was going out. And supposedly the money was put into a trust fund, but of course the trust fund was immediately spent and replaced with an IOU. That IOU, of course, is written by a government that today has to spend borrow $2.5 billion a day to pay its debts. Where are they going to get the additional money? They're going to need to fund Medicare this year and next year and next year and the year after that as it gets worse every year. And, of course, 3 years from now, all the baby boomers who are retiring will be eligible for Medicare as well. They know that there's no way out of this financial situation other than simply to inflate our way out. The alternative would be to have a major depression, destroy all this debt that's out there, to simply do away with Social Security and Medicare, or at least to restructure them, because there is no money to pay off the massive obligations that we have contracted with our people, and they've been lying all along. And they're lying about the trust fund. There is no Medicare trust fund. There is no Social Security trust fund. You're going to have to look after yourself, because believe me, the big boys are. They're, of course, investing in war stock because they know where we're going. Well, pray for America. Pray for revival. And please pray for Radio Liberty. Our number again, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and they have to be, hopefully, they're going to be the views of Dennis Wolfe, who we hope to have on the a line here in just a moment or two. I'm going to ask my producer to come in to make sure, of course, that our secretary had put down the right telephone number for Dennis. But Dennis Wolfe has been studying this issue of the Medicare for a good long while. And, of course, we've certainly asked him to come on and talk to us a little bit about where we are going with Medicare. It's not simply by accident that we were, of course, talking about this. Medicare is in real trouble, and of course you go into the background of what's going on today. Well, of course, we were told many years ago that there was absolutely nothing to worry about Medicare. Government had plenty of money to go ahead and take care of it, because it was only going to cost, by the year 1990, it was only going to cost $9 billion. Of course, by 1990, it cost $90 billion, and now it's cursed us up around $250, approaching $300 billion a year. And so they've been giving us false information all this time. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and certainly we're hoping to have Dennis Wolfe on in just a moment or two. But you have to understand that there is no money in the Medicare fund, and it's getting more and more expensive all the time. And, of course, what they've decided to do, and you haven't heard anything at all about this, they can't tell the American people that they've made all these promises and then they can't keep them. So any senior citizen, I think, makes more than $160,000, married or $80,000 single. Any American citizen, of course, who is making a fairly good salary when he's retired, is going to have to pay an increased cost for his Medicare benefits. And they're just going to have to, of course, keep increasing the Medicare benefits in an effort to have some sort of a solvency. But they're putting out so much money today that there's no way that anybody's going to be able to keep up with the Medicare payments. Right now, I think we pay about $1,200 a year for Medicare, another $1,200 a year for our Blue Cross to pick up 20% of this. Medicare is bankrupt, and there's no way, of course, we're going to be able to finance it. Well, let's go to Dennis, because he's done a lot of thinking about this. Hi, Dennis. Are you there?
I'm here.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you go ahead and give us your views on where do we stand with Medicare and what can be done?
Well, Medicare is an unmitigated disaster.
Now, are you on a hard line?
I am.
Okay, go right ahead.
Okay. It's an unmitigated disaster. Are you able to hear me okay?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay. The first thing we have to understand about Medicare is that it is completely bankrupt. I was listening to Cal in your last hour.
Right.
And I frankly echo everything he said. That man should be listened to. We have put our country in a precarious financial situation, and Medicare is probably one of the biggest reasons why we're in such terrific trouble right now. One of the key aspects of Medicare is it's such a failed system that doctors don't even want to accept Medicare, and that's why you've seen Congress...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Go right ahead, Dennis.
Okay. That's why you've seen Congress have to come up with this in their Balanced Budget Act, I believe it was, of 1997, why they had to admit that Medicare itself was such a failed system that they had to turn over the management of delivering health care services for reimbursement expenses, that is, to many of the insurance companies. That's where you've seen the advent of these Medicare Advantage programs. I'm sure you're familiar with them, Doctor.
Well, of course, a lot of these things are simply HMOs. They're a clever scheme for actually limiting access to medical care for the individual who actually retired and on Medicare. And you can't even, if you're on Medicare, you can't buy private insurance. And so many of these HMOs and Medicare Advantages are simply clever schemes to limit access to health care. And, of course, now the corporations are making a tremendous amount of money, and people are getting poorer health care.
That's an interesting observation you've just made, because, in fact, I mean, you are absolutely correct. In fact, the insurance companies knew that they had the government, and so what they said was, you know, we're not going to do this unless you guarantee us a profit. I find that just amazing. I mean, talk about it. Isn't an insurance company by definition a carrier that should take the risk? And here they are demanding the government guarantee them a profit.
And that's how the system works. And, of course, remember, the insurance companies all have lobbyists, and, of course, they pay the congressmen large sums of money in the way of, course, contributions to buy their votes. And that's how our system works, unfortunately. We've got some of the finest politicians in Washington, D.C. today that money could buy.
Here's one interesting comment. We're in the middle, of course, everybody knows, presidential election. We've got two candidates on the Democrat side who are telling us how they're going to make sure we get some kind of national program. What they fail to tell the consumers in this country is that they are backed heavily by the trial lawyers. The trial lawyers do not want any type of governmental national program because they wouldn't be able to sue the hospitals or any of the doctors or anybody involved. So we're never going to see it, even though it's a lot of lip service. And that's part of the problem in this country, is we need to have some kind of equity in delivering health care services across the board and not categorize people and shovel off our senior citizens who deserve the greatest respect in this country into this ridiculous Medicare program.
Well, not only that, of course, but so much of what they've been telling us as far as maintaining our health has been a lie for years. They told us, don't eat butter. My goodness, you're going to just clog up your arteries. You use these trans fats. Yeah, you use the margarine, knowing full well that they were far more dangerous than butter, of course. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Dennis Wolf. And Dennis, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself, who you are, and how you got involved and concerned about what's happening with our healthcare delivery system.
Okay. I went to school at San Jose State, graduated, and in 1976, and went right into the health insurance business. All of my friends in the business thought I was crazy, and I said, well, that's the future of this country. And only God knows why I got directed that way. In 1986, by that time I had already had a client that was a Fortune 500 company. I've since done multinational law firms, and I've done some big accounts, as well as a lot of small companies. I've been in the health insurance business for now 32 years. In 1986, Ted Kennedy and Nancy Katzenbaum stuck an amendment on the Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of that year, and that amendment has since become known as COBRA, the acronym of the actual act itself. And everybody in this country knows what COBRA is. It is the ability to continue your benefits past your employment date with the company, and thereby putting the insurance company at additional risk for paying out claims. When I saw that act had passed in 1986, going into effect in July of 1987, I knew immediately, having a background in finance, that's my degree, and I have a minor in organic and biochemistry and a couple of years of neurological study, I knew immediately we were headed towards a spiraling out-of-control cost crisis by the early 90s because the handwriting was on the wall. In knowing this, I decided I better write a book, and I started writing a book about it and what we needed to do and how we needed to change our delivery system of health care as well as how we fund it. And I wrote that book and published it in 1991. Some of the ideas that I wrote in that book, Doctor, I I humbly say, today are considered visionary because they're using them in some respects. The book was used extensively in 93-94 in Congress. I worked heavily all by myself and kept educating all the congressmen that I could get a hold of on the issue of what of why HillaryCare was such a devastating plan for this country. And finally, it was defeated in 1994. I take only the credit to the degree that I was able to hopefully maybe educate a few congressmen. But regardless, thank God it was defeated. That legislation was the most devastating piece of legislation I think I've ever seen, and I'm a real student of the history of this country. May I continue?
Go right ahead.
One of the things that I think people did not realize with HillaryCare, and I aptly named it HillaryCare, as everybody else calls it that as well, is that Hillary Clinton was legislating into her Health Security Task Force Act. She was legislating in social engineering. And I don't think people realize just how comprehensively bad this would have wrecked our society. She was going to dictate which doctor you went to, and if you didn't go to that doctor, you could be guilty of what she actually labeled in the act, literally penalties equivalent to felonies, $10,000 fines, 6 months in prison, lose your right to vote. It's just unbelievable what she was doing. And I think enough people in Congress, even they woke up, because that was a democratically controlled Congress. So with its failure, I figured we had some breathing room. But one of the things that I wrote back then, and we're seeing it come to pass today, and it ties brilliantly into what you said when you opened the show, the Medicare issue, is that the cost of health care is rising in proportionate to the rest of the gross domestic product at a double-digit rate of increase. And I don't want to go into all the math here because we'll lose every listener on this show. But the bottom line is that health care today, if you really factor in every ancillary service that relates to it, is pretty much about half of our gross domestic product. And it's real close to that. And with the baby boomers aging, as you and Cal were talking about earlier, and the impact on society, the bottom line is that we as a society are headed towards a financial calamity where we become nothing but a consumptive society of health care services instead of focusing on our health. So that's kind of a brief background of where I started with this. The book title, as you know, is labeled The Sixth Solution, A Prescription for National Health. It doesn't say health care. And the reason why is because it was my contention then, it is my contention now, and it will always be my contention that how we address the delivery of health care services at an affordable cost in this country is how we will move forward as a society.
And I think it is a great deal of truth to that. Of course, we did not have a health care crisis back in 1965 when Medicare was introduced. They kept talking about the health care crisis, but I was practicing medicine in those days. And I will tell you that certainly we had good quality medicine. Everybody in America could get health care. Now, admittedly, we had county hospitals in Sydney, every single county in this entire nation. And if county didn't have a county hospital, then they were responsible for paying for the patient's care in an adjacent county. And admittedly, of course, when people died, if they had a home and they developed large bills, well, of course, the county ended up with that house. So they would be able to continue affording to pay health care. But certainly nobody went without health care. Certainly we had clinics, and they were imperfect. I practiced in the system, but I never was not able. Sometimes I'd have to go and fight with the hospital administrator to get the expensive drugs, but we always were able to get them and to take good care of patients. And doctors used to, of course, spend time taking care of patients for nothing. The good doctors went out to the county hospitals or even took care of patients for nothing in their own practices because doctors were doing fairly well financially. Are not doing well financially today. They can't afford. They keep telling you how wealthy doctors are. I will tell you that right today, Of course, it was 1960. I used to get $4 an office visit, or maybe even $5 an office visit when prices went up. Today, that same office visit would cost you probably $75 to $100 as a direct result of government involvement in the healthcare system. I can remember when the hospital room cost $13 a day and that it covered everything. Today, it will cost you about $1,000, $1,500 a day, all a direct result of government coming in and interfering with the healthcare system. There's no problem facing medicine today that a new government program won't make worse. But you go ahead, Dennis.
Well, I agree with everything you say. In fact, a friend of mine and I were talking about this the other day, and he said that when his grandfather was in the hospital back in the 30s for 3 or 4 days of surgery and recuperative time, the bill came to $7. I mean, the inflationary values in health care are just outrageous.
And, of course, at those times, the hospitals were actually there to help people and to minister to them. Now they're there to make a profit for the board and certainly for the stockholders. We've changed the whole concept. Patients are no longer patients. They're consumers. Doctors are not doctors. They're providers. And, of course, people did not understand that government interfering in this system has created a monster, and there's no way out of it until the whole system collapses, and it's going to collapse one of these days. But go ahead, Dennis.
Well, again, I agree, and the thing that scares me more than anything else, and I think you really nailed it. Are you there?
I certainly am.
One of the things that really scares me, and again, I said you just hit it perfectly, is that people have no concept of how this system works. They don't know what to do when they go in the hospital. They put themselves at the mercy of the hospital. My wife and I were in Russia 4 years ago. She fell over there, and because of my somewhat neurological background, I had an immediate understanding that she had a subdermal hematoma. She was bleeding in the brain. But it wasn't so severe that it needed hospitalization, and we were able to get her home without having to hospitalize her overseas. She ended up having to have 2 surgeries to drain the blood, and the hospital, the care was abysmal. They treated her like a number. If I didn't have the knowledge I had, plus the working knowledge of the system, I truly believe to this day she probably would have died there. She recovered, and I had to help work with them to get her into a rehabilitative facility to help recover from the stroke symptoms that result from the pressure on the brain. It was amazing to me, and I thought to myself, my God, if I had to do this and I know what's going on, what does the average person go through when they go to a hospital? And I think they have no clue. So it's in my book I wrote back then in 1991, and my wife's situation reinforced it today. Hospitals today are where I believe you go to die, not where you go to get well. And you're far better off looking at alternative health care, looking at good nutritional programs, learning the value of stress management, taking classes and educating yourself. Hence the title of the book, A Prescription for National Health.
But, of course, the thing is that there is a place we need hospitals. If you have a broken hip, if you have you need subdural decompression because of a subdural hematoma. There's lots of places where we have to have hospitals. We certainly need to have the ability for open heart surgery, as I did, where, I was able to get a new valve put in. Of course, I wouldn't want to tell our listeners what that hospital bill was. Fortunately, you paid for it for me. I have Medicare, and I have Blue Cross didn't cost me a cent, but I do know that the doctor's fee was $11,000. The valve that they put in was $3,000. Now, the problem is that Medicare drives those fees up because they do not pay the bill. Well, that may pay $2,000 or $3,000 at the most. But of course, then if you were to go in and you did not have Medicare, you'd get stuck with that $11,000 bill. Why? Because the government says you have to bill everybody the same amount. We're not going to pay that amount, but we're going to drive the price up for everybody else. And the same thing is true as the hospitalization. The Medicare does not pay the cost of hospitalization. Many times the hospitals will lose money on every Medicare patient that comes in. So then how do they get the money? Why, they do something called cost shifting. And, of course, since those people over 65 are getting free health care, those people under 65 who have either no insurance or private insurance are paying for the cost of the government wards. And, ladies and gentlemen, it is simply going to get worse and worse and worse as prices spiral and the care actually declines precipitously. Well, Dennis, you pick the story up.
Okay. First of all, what you said is very interesting because it leads to an interesting thing that we've been seeing in the papers for years, how hospitals claim they're losing money. They're not losing money. What they're doing is they are indeed shifting the cost, and then they negotiate these contracts for the under 65 market. My wife's hospital bill was $110,000 for 7 days. The amount that the insurance company paid with when the contracted amount was significantly less than that, somewhere around $30,000 or $40,000. But the hospital booked it in their books as $110,000. They get paid, I think it was $30,000 or $40,000, somewhere in that range. And since it's been booked at $110,000, they write off the difference and they call that a loss. But yet the $35,000 or so that they received was adequate enough to pay all their expenses. And then they come around and they say they've lost. What needs to be done in this country is I do want to correct a statement I made earlier, where as I said, hospitals are where you go to die. Hospitals are that's the image a lot of people have. When they go there, they feel totally functionally useless. And I think we need to change that to where people can see hospitals as a great healing center focusing on health instead of focusing on health care. That's a very big issue, and it's one that the average consumer has to grasp.
And I certainly agree with you, but the thing is, of course, that many of the things that are being recommended for people simply are not good for them. For instance, being told, all children and certainly all people over 65 should have an influenza shot. Why? Because 36,000 people die every year of influenza. Of course, that isn't true. Other people are dying of pneumonia. It has nothing to do with influenza. They're not dying of the influenza. The influenza vaccine doesn't help, but it does hurt. It contains mercury in the elderly. It increases the incidence of Alzheimer's disease in the youth. It contributes to autism, certainly the ADHD. Why would you want to be giving a vaccine that contained a significant amount of mercury and aluminum to both young and to older people? And yet, what we're doing when we advise people to take the vaccinations, we're producing harm. It is not simply by accident. The incidence of asthma is increasing in our children. You don't see it in children who don't get the vaccinations. The incidence of autoimmune disease is increasing. You don't see it in the children who don't get vaccinated. One in every six children today in America has a neurodevelopmental abnormality, according to the CDC. You don't see it in the children who don't get vaccination, like the Amish children or the other children in religious sects that don't believe in vaccination. What they're doing actually so much of is actually hurting our health, poisoning our food with MSG or certainly with aspartame. I mean, putting fluoride in their drinking water, which actually is carcinogenic, not telling the people so many of the things that produce cancer. We used to have at the beginning of the last century, 1900s, why, because one person in 33 contracted cancer. Today it's one person in two, and they know why cancer is going up. And, of course, they're not telling the American people. Go ahead.
You bring up another thing that I focus on, and that is that people, when they don't know how to respond to this, do whatever the doctor or the medical community tells them they should be doing. When you have a plumber at your house, the very first thing you ask that plumber is, how much is this going to cost? What are you doing? And when the plumber tells you, the very next question out of your mouth is, can you fix it a cheaper way for now, and what would you be doing to do that?
Hold on. All right, our guest is Dennis Wolfe, and Dennis, of course, has written a book about what's going on here, A Prescription for National Health. Go right ahead.
Well, what I started to say about the plumber analogy is that people are so uneducated when it comes to the nutrition, health care, their own anatomy, that they just pick up bits and pieces. But if we mandated and we offered an aspect of healthcare delivery of healthcare services with mandated healthcare classes and got people focusing on being healthier instead of doing whatever the doctor says with respect to all these immunizations and some unnecessary surgeries, we would find ourselves becoming a better and productive society. People are focusing too much. They run to the doctor because they notice that a little patch of skin turned red on their arm, and maybe it's just a skin rash from poison oak and they could treat it if they knew it. Instead, they fill up doctor's offices for the most inane little things because they don't know any better. We have hypnotized our citizens into running to the doctor for everything. And why? I think it's because the corporations know that they make a lot more money if they can get people in the doctor's office.
Agreed. And, of course, one of the biggest scams today is the statin drugs, of course, giving them to everybody. And if you look at the statistics, if you haven't had a previous heart attack or stroke and you take statin drugs, they do absolutely no good as far as decreasing your death or morbidity. They do not tell you that. They tell you, everybody, if you have a high cholesterol, you've got to get on statin drugs. And the statin drugs do work. They poison your liver and they lower your cholesterol level. But half the people who die of heart attacks have a normal or low cholesterol, and they still die. So anyway, of course, but Dennis, you want, of course, to mandate health care classes, and yet if you mandate them, you're using government. If you use government to mandate, of course, they're going to tell you what the CDC wants the people to know, and much of this is really hazardous to their health. How can we get people to be concerned about their health care and go to responsible sources for information rather than going to those of the government when the government has an agenda, and that is population control, and so much of what they're doing and telling people just is not true and is actually harmful to their health?
Well, one of the things that took me, it took me 5 years to write my book, because I looked at it and I said, we need a solution that gives people local control over the delivery of their health care services and not at a federal level. I think the biggest mistake people make, and I'm just astounded how many people praise the glory of the England system or the Canadian system, and if I got into that subject, we'd be here all night. So let me just say that with respect to those two systems, they're failing so badly that England is now giving incentives for employers to go out and buy private insurance, and Canada is actually importing health care services from the United States and then having the United States hospitals bill them at the beginning of their new provincial health budget year. So these systems are chaotic and they've failed miserably. And these are the systems that people who want national government insurance want to give us, and that's a disaster. So the first thing I said in my book was we must break the system down to where we can regionalize the health care, allow local hospitals, allow local doctors the opportunity to continue practicing entrepreneurially if they so desire, and allow citizens locally to control the cost of health care. And one of the factors in that control is deciding how they want to help educate the citizens within their own community. It's a very complex subject. You just can't, it's like the old story of how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time. And that's what we're at with this. The worst thing we're trying to do is put a bandage over a hole in the dam. And if we don't start looking at it regionally and start looking at how we can educate our citizens in local communities and have them become accountable for the services they seek within their own communities, we will never solve this problem. And as you said earlier, and as Cal, your previous guest, said, we're going to just go right over the abyss.
Well, I certainly agree with you, but I'd like to know how we can get people educated on proper health care, because I will tell you, when I was a practicing physician, I really understand nutrition. I mean, I took what the Centers for Disease Control and the FDA and the said as gospel, after all. I mean, certainly wouldn't it be wonderful if we could get everybody's cholesterol down and stop heart attacks. And, of course, I didn't have time to read the articles in the medical literature that said statin drugs don't work. But it's a multi-billion-dollar-a-year business, and certainly the government's not going to tell you, because the FDA, Federal Drug Administration, is actually funded by the drug companies. You don't know that, but that's the truth. They provide much of the money that goes into their salaries, and so much of the advice that's coming from the FDA is harmful to your health. Much of the advice from the CDC is aimed at population control. I mean, how are we going to come up with a program to educate people about their health and give them proper information, not what the government's putting out, which in many instances is frankly hazardous for the health of our people? Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, is Dennis Wolf, and he's been in the healthcare business for a long time. On the other end of this, of course, providing healthcare policies for a Fortune 500 companies. And Dennis, you pick up the story from there. But how would we establish a local program for healthcare where people are going to get the truth rather than the disinformation that comes from so many of the well-meaning doctors who know nothing about nutrition, who know nothing about the importance of minerals, who know nothing about the importance of certain vitamins, and who do not know, for instance, the dangers of water fluoridation. The doctors are pushing this. The doctors, of course, pushing dentists are pushing the mercury fillings, and yet, of course, all the evidence shows terribly harmful these things are. How can we get people to get educated about their health? Do you have any suggestions?
Well, one of the things that I think that's often lost is the old phrase financial incentives. Right now, one of the things I said back then in the early 90s and late 80s when I wrote the book was we needed to offer financial incentives where people would go, I'm willing to take those classes and do a little research on my own and take the programs offered in my local region. A region could be a county, it could be a portion of a large county, et cetera, or groups of counties, dependent on if they're rural. But I'm willing to take those classes because if I do so, then I don't have to pay as large a portion of my hospital or my medical charges, and that's an incentive for me to take better care of myself. We're missing the point in terms of, as Americans, in terms of health, because we're not seeking health, we're seeking health care all the time. Now, the question you've asked is one that, frankly, I'm honest enough to admit, I don't know how we can overcome this problem. It may be so insurmountable that we cannot overcome it, but if we don't look at ways that we can possibly consider, then we are indeed going to go down a bad path. Citizens need to start demanding more from the doctors out there. Doctors need to remember that they took the Hippocratic Oath, not a hypocritical oath. There are so many good doctors out there who I believe really, really want to do a great job for their patients, but they themselves don't know where to turn anymore. You brought up the issue that I think is the most critical one, and that is, what is the hidden agenda behind the funding of many of the tests that are out there? I told my doctor years ago, you're never going to get me to take one of those statin drugs. And my cholesterol is like 160. And he keeps saying, but you should, because you're overweight, you could have a heart attack. Then let me know.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Dennis Wolf, and certainly we're talking about the very real problems in healthcare delivery today. And of course, Dennis is stressing the fact that we need to health maintenance and health improvement rather than health care. So, Dennis, do you have a website? How can people get copies of your book?
Well, they can buy the book at Amazon.com. The name of the book, again, is The Sixth Solution, A Prescription for National Health by J. Dennis Wolf. They can also contact me at jdwolf.com, and it is JDWOLFE. So I'd be happy to communicate with people directly. They can email me at jdwolf@jdwolf.com. So the email and the website are all the same, jdwolfe.com. One of the things that I think, because I always get people say, well, what's your hidden agenda, Dennis? What do you want out of this? And I'd like to answer that, if I may, Doc. I wrote a book that wrote me out of a career. I believe that we are wasting so much money giving it to the insurance companies to pay for all this care, that unless we start looking at how each party to the table has to give up a portion of its control, we're never going to solve this problem. The insurance industry needs to stop writing group health insurance. That the doctors themselves need to all look together to see how they can coordinate their services within the region. The hospitals need to get together. It's a matter of everybody sitting down at the table and everybody putting their cards on the table and say, okay, what portion can we give up? What portion can we keep? How can we make the system work for the best? And until the parties that are in the mix, the insurance companies, the medical community, the pharmaceutical industry, it's almost like living in a Don Quixote world chasing windmills. But it took me 5 years to kind of put a plan together, And as, when people, if people buy the book or contact me, they'll start to learn a little bit more about what they can do individually. And the only thing they can do individually is put more pressure right now on their elected officials to stop talking about government-controlled health care at the national level.
And, Chris, I think the biggest thing is you have to have individual responsibility. Well, when people are paying to go to see the doctor, they're not going to go unless they really need to. When you go to see the doctor, it doesn't cost you anything. Why, you're going to go to see him every day. I can remember a fellow coming into my office, and I said to him, why did you come in today? Because he was a frequent patient. And he said, oh, my wife is going shopping. I didn't want to go with her, so I thought I'd come to see you. Came in for a doctor's visit. But it didn't cost him anything. And, you know, this is the thing. We have to get back to individual responsibility, and at least where the patient has to put out some of the money on his own part when he goes to see the doctor, when he gets health care services. And the idea you're going to get 100% health care coverage only encourages people to take advantage of the system. It's only human nature. This is why socialized medicine doesn't work. It's because when it doesn't cost anything, people will abuse it, of course. Whatever you subsidize, you get more of. Whatever you put this incentives in there, you cut back overuse. If you want people on welfare, you subsidize welfare. You want people working, why, of course, you subsidize working.
Exactly.
It's just common sense, but, of course, that's not the government solution. Socialized medicine is really all about control, control over you, your life, your children, and, of course, your very future.
That your comment there was exactly what I wrote in one of the papers. I believe I might have sent you to help bring you up to speed on what I'm talking about. And that is, very simply and succinctly said, the moment government controls us with national health care, they control the amount of services that they will offer to the local communities, and they don't have to worry about any accountability. Citizens must become accountable for the services they seek and for the cost that they are going to have to pay for it. We cannot transfer that or shift that cost to a federal government, because ultimately that means more taxes that will go towards completely unaccountable services. And if the government doesn't like the way something's going on in one particular region, they'll just simply cut off the funding or limit the services in that area till those people decide to vote the way they want them to vote. It is very, very dangerous to move towards a socialized healthcare system.
Well, it really is. And, Chris, let me give you an example of that.
Yeah.
I was thinking of that the other day. Suddenly I knew a very good friend of mine. He was a physician, and he had a tear of a supraspinatus tendon. And the doctor repaired it, as sometimes happens. Why, the repair doesn't work, and you have to do a much more exhaustive repair. But the doctor who'd done the repair wasn't about to repeat the operation. Why? Because the government is looking over the doctor's shoulders, is grading all the doctors, and if a doctor has to repeat an operation, then he gets graded down. So the doctor says, there's nothing I can do for you, and I knew that wasn't true. It had been had I been the physician, I would have said, look, we need to do a more extensive repair, and this is what needs to be done, we'll do it. But when the government, of course, is looking over your shoulder, are you really going to, you know, do what's right for your patient? Are you going to want to come up with a grading sheet, an evaluation sheet from the government that makes you look better? And so you then begin to deprive patients of good care. And this is happening all across America today. Government pays more for very complicated operative procedures. You can either do a simple operative procedure, readily done, very few complications, and you get a very small amount of money for it. You can do a very complicated procedure, same result, but of course you get a lot more money for it. Are you going to do the complicated procedure or the simple procedure?
Yeah.
You're going to do the complicated procedure because you're going to be rewarded financially by the government.
Yeah.
And of course, because government is interfering, doctors are compromising their principles. After all, they're making far less money today in many respects than I was making back in 1960 when you take into account inflation. Go ahead.
One of my friends is a retired anesthesiologist at 44 years of age. He couldn't take it anymore. He couldn't afford to stay in business because the costs were killing him. As you know, doctor, and as most consumers do not know, the anesthesiologist is the only person licensed in this country to kill you and bring you back to life. I say that tongue-in-cheek, of course, but the fact is that they hold your life in their hands when you go under the knife. And the pressures on them are unbelievable, and so is their insurance premium when you look at what it costs to reflect that risk. He burnt out at 44 years of age. That is just remarkable. And looked at the system and realized it was so badly broken, he didn't want to continue to practice. And he's looking at other alternative ways to deliver care, and he's doing a great job at it because he has the knowledge. As I said earlier, many doctors have sacrificed the Hippocratic Oath for the hypocritical oath. Some doctors I know are actually now selling, using the power of their MD license to sell things out of their office instead of practicing medicine. I think that is the most abysmal thing I've ever seen when it comes to the medical services. It's a system where the doctors have been pushed to where they have to do whatever it takes to survive, and that is a real tragedy because the art of medicine is such a beautiful thing. It's an opportunity to give people a chance at a better life, and we force doctors to sacrifice everything they've trained for. That has to be addressed, and it isn't going to be addressed with a nationalized system. It's only going to get worse.
And, of course, before we had, of course, the government providing care for everybody and now beginning to ration care for everybody, doctors could afford to take care of patients for nothing. But because, of course, what they've done, fixing doctors' fees and then cutting back doctors' fees and cutting back doctors' fees, everybody tells you about the rich doctors. Well, there may be a few of them out there, but I'll tell you, most of my friends, you know, whenever I see them and I say, how are things going, they say, oh, boy, I wish I could retire like you do.
Yeah.
And this is true.
Yeah,
the
true.
Doctors are simply under tremendous pressure. Their incomes are down. But you're not being told that. Of course, everything's being done to make you believe that all doctors are rich, and I'll tell you that's just not true.
No.
You go right ahead.
It is absolutely not true. In fact, in 1976, as you let me say earlier when I started, you know, my background is a medical science background. Gee, do you have to guess what I was looking to move into? Of course I was looking to move into medicine. I wanted to go into medical research. I chose to go switch my degree to business because even in 1976, as I saw the medical community changing, with Ted Kennedy back then pushing nationalized health insurance, I said, you know, by the time I get out of my specialties in neurology, I don't think I'm going to make any money. So I switched to health insurance and started selling health insurance using the knowledge I have of medical science to help my clients. Doctors today are in such a jam, it's unbelievable. And the sad part is, and I don't think the public knows this, and you probably can and help a little bit answer this, doctor. But I think most people don't know that many, many doctors are told in medical school, well, there's not enough, you can't go into that specialty, or you can't do this. If you want to do that, you have to do this. They limit how doctors can educate themselves for some of the specialties they want to go into. That's rationing.
Sure. Well, of course, it's unfortunate, but this is the way things are today. But then so many of the younger doctors don't want to go out and go into a specialty where they're going to have to work hard. They're more interested in, you know, and lots of time for vacation for the time for themselves and lots of benefits. And this is why, of course, they go to work for HMOs and elsewhere so they can put in a 40-hour week and then, of course, have the weekends off. Ladies and gentlemen, when I first went into medical practice, you know, we worked 7 days a week. We worked every other night. I mean, but that was the tradition of medicine. We were there to take care of patients. We were there to help them. But no longer do we have patients. We have consumers. They've changed the wording, and, of course, they've changed the relationship between the doctor and the patient. And, of course, it's really he who pays the piper calls the tune, and who's paying the money? Why, the insurance company, the HMO,
exactly.
PPO, or the government. And
exactly.
Believe me, of course, what we've done is we've created a monster, and of course, the solution? Well, we want socialized medicine where the government will pay for everything and regulate everything, and we'll end up as it is in Eastern Europe, where the only way you get medical care is to bribe the doctor and bribe the nurse and bribe the people in the hospital. Otherwise, you're going to die. That's the way the system works. In a truly socialized medical system, I've talked to doctors who worked behind the Iron Curtain, and that's what it was all about. And that's exactly what they're bringing in here today, because the same mentality that created communism in Russia is working right in Washington, D.C. In fact, some of these people are even running for the presidency.
One thing you brought up there is kind of interesting. If I may rewind the clock 16 years ago, when the Clintons first ran for the White House in 1992, Hillary Clinton went around telling everybody, gee, nobody can get health care. But in 1992, we had the opposite problem with many of the insurance carriers. And by the way, I agree with you 100%. They are holding all the aces, and they are dictating the entire direction of cost of health care in this country. And that's a tragedy for America. But getting back to Hillary, she was going around squawking. Nobody could get health care. That wasn't the problem then. With all the carriers pulling out of the market because of the impact of COBRA, and we had a health care cost crisis in 1990 and 91, what you could get is you could get care, but you didn't have insurance to pay for it. And the doctors were screaming bloody murder because their cash flows were all dried up because they were so addicted to the PPO benefits of the carriers paying out claims like blank checks. So by 1996, when the Clintons ran for re-election, the HMOs had totally, completely confiscatory control over the doctor's cash flow, and as a result, care had to be cut back significantly. The doctors didn't have enough money. The hospitals didn't have enough money. And what was Hillary Clinton saying in 96? She said, geez, nobody can afford to get insurance. Well, by 1996, the cost of the HMO premiums was very low because the hospitals and doctors were so contractually constricted. So you couldn't get care. In other words, it was exactly opposite in each of those 2 4-year periods, and yet the public thinks Hillary Clinton is so knowledgeable. I think she's dangerous.
I know she's dangerous. We've got Mike calling on the line from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How you doing?
Yeah, hi, Stan. I wondered if we could have a little commentary on that movie Sicko.
Oh, I'd love to comment on that.
Piece.
Sure, why don't you go ahead and comment on it, Dennis? I didn't see it all. I know it's secondhand, but you saw it. Tell us what you think.
I believe that Michael Moore is a perfect definition of a capitalist pig. Here's a man who took advantage of people who had health care problems, financial dilemmas, and I don't know that he demonstrated any compassion because he just kept all the money for himself and made a fortune off that movie. That movie is a complete, it's a perfect example of modern-day yellow journalism.
Well, it's heavy promotion of socialized medicine.
Well, what you don't know about that movie is that he was quietly working with Representative Conyers out of Michigan, and Conyers right now, I believe, I don't know what the status of it is quietly pushing a nationalized health insurance bill through Congress, which no one really seems to be aware of, and he worked in conjunction with Conyers to promote that movie. The bottom line is, I go back to what I said about a few minutes ago, without going into too much detail, but I'd be happy to, anybody emails me, I'll be happy to send them a paper on it, and that is the destructive power of what's happened in England and Canada, which are the two systems that everybody praises as the most perfect systems in the world. They are complete examples of disaster and what Dr. Stan here is talking about with socialized medicine.
Dennis, maybe we could get you on again sometime soon, and we could just go into what's really happened in England, what's really happened in Canada, and, of course, what this is costing the people, because it's phenomenally expensive.
Oh, and may I say one thing?
Sure, you can say whatever you want to.
Well, I've been to England so many times that I've lost count, and with every trip that I've been over there since the late 80s, early 90s, every single time I turn on the TV, the number one topic on every news show is the corruption in the national health system over there.
Well, Mike, do you have anything you want to say before we let you go?
It was just interesting timing, the way that movie came out, something like 2 years before the next election, and now we have this big push towards socialized health care again. And so a lot of people were deeply impressed by the movie and thought it was all the truth.
I think it's so important, Mike, that people understand that the people who are pushing socialism are people of great wealth. Why do they want socialism? Well, because, of course, when all power is controlled in Washington, D.C., why, of course, the people who have enough money to buy and control the populace, the politicians, will rule our country. And once you have socialized medicine, why, of course, these people of great wealth will be able to control your health care. And many of these people are dedicated to population control. It is the major thrust of the elite, starting with the Club of Rome back in 1971 in their book, The Limits of Growth, and then the Sustainable Development Programs that came out of the Second Earth Summit in 1992. Their major thrust is there are too many people in the world. We've got to kill most of them off. If you don't believe that's their program, read the Global Biodiversity Assessment that came out of the Second Earth Summit, published by the Cambridge University Press. You get it summarized in our Sustainable Development Syllabus. Do you really want to put your life and your health and your children's and your family's health in the hands of people who believe in population control, who believe there are too many useless eaters out there? That's exactly their philosophy. Our guest this evening has been Dennis Wolfe. Mike, thanks so much for calling. And
thanks,
Dennis,
Mike.
You hang on. We've got just a couple of more minutes before we have to let you go right here at Radio Liberty. Well, Dennis, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program. I do want to get you on again. If I don't call you, you call me, because we really need to get these subjects before the American people.
I would be honored to be back on, and hopefully the process that you and I have here will, maybe we just might be igniting people around this country to stand up and start asking questions. I welcome anybody to send me an email to jdwolfe@jdwolfe.com. I soon will be at a newspaper called the Tri-City Voice here in the San Francisco Bay Area, but it's viewed all over the world. That's tricityvoice.com. They plan TriCityVoice, and they will be handling my column, and you can read it all over the internet. People who buy my book, if they send me a receipt showing me they can get my address from my website, jdwolfe.com. If they send me a receipt, I'll happily send them a couple of goodies and papers, and they can hopefully start educating the people around them. One last thing I think is really important, Doc, is that I absolutely will not charge for my time to go anywhere to give speaking engagements or to present my ideas and thoughts. All I ask for is just the travel expenses only, hard dollar expenses. I believe that nobody should be making money off of this issue. We should be working together. I've been blessed to have a good career. I want to do everything I can to help people raise the bar and start asking the questions we need to ask in this country.
Well, that certainly is admirable. I certainly agree with you. And I think that people have to understand that socialized medicine is simply part of this program to establish a fascist America in a fascist world controlled by people of good, of great wealth. And of course, this has to do with the establishment of the New World Order, the New World Religion, and of course, the enthronement of the New World Leader. Well, Mike, certainly I agree with basically for what you're doing. Certainly the way we got Mike was by a good friend of ours, Dr. John Toth, who I've known for 30 years, and he said, you've got to get Dennis Wolfe on the line there, and so this is why we have Dennis with us tonight, and we do hope to have him again several more times on some of our other stations, because this is one of the major issues. Certainly whoever is elected president, they're going to be putting pressure on Congress to enact socialized medicine, and socialized medicine is really an acronym for rationed healthcare that is dedicated to population reduction. Dennis, thank you very much for being with us, as always.
You're very welcome, and may God bless all the listeners. We really need to do something.
Amen to that. Okay, fine. Well, this has been Dennis Wolfe, and we do hope, of course, that many of you will want to get his book, The Sick Solution, and, of course, if you need more information... Well, this is Dr. Stan. If you need information on Dennis Wolfe's book, The Sick Solution, why, we'll be glad to help you get that. And we will have Dennis back on again. But you must put things into their proper perspective. This move towards socialized medicine is all about controlling you and controlling your health. And who wants to do this? Why, of course, the Brotherhood of Darkness. If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. And, of course, you can watch the CD from which, or should I should say the DVD, up on our website from which the book came. I gave this talk back perhaps in the late 1990s, and somebody saw it and said, we want to put that into a book. And so that's how the book came about. Website is radioliberty.com. We have a section there where you can see our free DVDs. This topic is the Brotherhood of Darkness. Of course, we hope that you want to get the book because it gives you all of the documentation. But the story is there, and it's a very powerful story. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you will want to get my talk on the forbidden secret, which, of course, will take you into who is really behind these people of great wealth who want to control your life. That's forbidden secret, and there's a syllabus that comes with that. We have a three-pamphlet set called The Occult Hierarchy. The Occult Hierarchy, it's a compilation of my writings and the writings of Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and we certainly recommend that as well. And, of course, we have so much material. We hope you go to our website at radioliberty.com and, of course, get the information there and then encourage other people to listen, to understand that behind everything going on today, there are powerful spiritual forces. We have a four-tape set called The Supernatural. The Supernatural. And one of the people who we interview is of course, Joanna... she wrote the book, The Beautiful Side of Evil. And, of course, she's one of our favorite guests here, and her name will come to me. The Beautiful Side of Evil, The Supernatural is the name of the four-tape set. We have, of course, a book entitled Diary of a Devil Hunter. And, of course, we have another book called The Hostage to the Devil. And, of course, there's a four-tape set that goes with that called The Wisdom of Malachi Martin. And, of course, the person we're trying to think of is Joanna Michelson, who wrote the book The Beautiful Side of Evil. We have a four-tape set and a book called Satanic Crimes. And, of course, what most people don't understand is that so many of the very famous crimes, whether it be the Son of Sam killings or Charles Manson or the Hillside Strangler or certainly the strange situation surrounding the murder of Captain Jeffrey McDonald's family. Of course, Jeffrey McDonald was a Green Beret officer, medical officer, who was accused and convicted of killing his wife and his children. And, of course, this was really on the part of the government's effort to cover up another of the satanic crimes. There really are satanic crimes. There are satanic cults. There's satanic covens. And, of course, their existence has been carefully concealed by people within the CIA and at the highest levels of our government. And you'll find much of this story being told in the book, Satanic Crimes. I don't know if it goes into Captain Jeffrey McDonald, but if you want information on that, you can get some of my interviews with Ted Gunderson. We have a two-hour interview with him, a very important interview that will give you a true insight into the very real satanic crimes and covens which are operating in the United States today. So remember, go to our website at radioliberty.com if you'd like to get into the items we've talked about. The number is 1-800-544-8927. Understand we're involved in a spiritual battle that is being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield, but it is a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization, because you cannot understand these people who want a world government, who want, of course, to get a new world religion and destroy Christianity. Unless you understand the spiritual forces that energize them, and well covered in my talk entitled The Hidden Agenda, or, of course, the Forbidden Secret, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and pray for America.